Cascadia. Today is Tuesday, February 9th, 2010, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. And this is Air Cascadia, long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
How far is offshore when it comes to a ban on offshore drilling?
The League of Minority Voters is offering scholarships to white people to help them overcome racism.
And KBR, that's Kellogg, Brown and Root, wants a federal judge to throw out the Oregon National Guardsman's hexavalent chromium suit.
Portland area weather today, mostly sunny with a high near 53. Tonight, mostly cloudy, low around 40. And then tomorrow, occasional rain and a little cooler.
And first we go to regional news from around Cascadia. The Oregon League of Minority Voters either has a wicked sense of humor or is Oregon's answer to Nelson Mandela, or maybe both. The League is going to offer scholarships to white students, and only white students, in a bid to get people in the majority to study race relations in college. The idea is to get students to translate what they learn in school into action in their lives. Recipients must live in Oregon. They can't be of Asian, African, Latino, or Native American descent. Nicole Mayer, executive director of the Native American Youth Family Center in Portland, isn't 100% behind the idea. She would like to see members of minority groups leading discussions on poverty, discrimination in schools. There are no easy solutions in a state and a city where racism is so deeply entrenched, even the most liberal citizen is barely even aware of it.
Earlier this month, Western Oregon University reported that it led the nation in improving the graduation rate of its minority students. It turns out the Education Trust, the organization that crunched the numbers, may have some mathematics issues itself. But even with the correction, Western saw an increase of 16 percentage points in the graduation rate of its underrepresented minority students, African American, Latino, and Native American students, which puts it among the top 10 gains in the nation.
There's a connection there, in fact, several. It's probably a more tangled web than we can imagine. And then there is the problem of too much excellence for one school district. In this case, the Riverdale School District, where nearly every student is high achieving and almost none come from families of modest means. Apparently, it was just too much for District Superintendent Terry Hoagland to handle. Hoagland is resigning this June in order to get away from the Riverdale high achievers and back to helping low-achieving schools and low-achieving students get better. That's something he accomplished in his previous jobs as principal of Lacombe and Riverview schools in Lebanon, where most students are, in fact, low-income. There should be no difficulty in drawing a line directly between low-income areas and low-achieving students. There's definitely a one-to-one ratio.
Yesterday, Metro and the three Portland area counties approved a long-range planning map that designates which areas will be developed and which will be reserved for farms and forests for the next 40 to 50 years. It's been 2 years of meeting, public hearings, and private backroom deal-making, not to mention the tense exchanges among the core four, representatives of the regional government Metro and Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. The resulting map approved by the group designates about 270,000 acres as rural reserves and about 27,000 acres as urban reserves, areas where the urban growth boundary will be expanded to allow development. The urban reserves represent only an 11% expansion of the urban growth boundary, even though the region's population is projected to grow by 60 to 70% over the same period.
Probably because of the fact that since we do have urban growth boundaries and we limit suburban sprawl, it makes the region more attractive, more people come. But then, of course, when we think about the population growth over the next couple of decades, some of that inevitably is going to be environmental disaster refugees when climate change really starts to rock and roll, which it will, of course, within the next 10, 20, 30 years. It is right now, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to speak very shortly to Ben Cannon, Representative Oregon. He was instrumental in passing legislation that would ban offshore drilling along Oregon's coasts for 10 years. We'll be speaking with him in just a moment. He's just come out of committee meeting. We're going to forge ahead. Liam, what have you got?
War contractor Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, won contracts to restore oil production after the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. National Guard troops were ordered to guard KBR employees who were in turn guarding the oil and restoring the flow. In the course of carrying out this dubious task, the National Guardsmen were exposed to the known carcinogen hexavalent chromium. 21 Oregon soldiers are suing KBR, alleging breathing and other health problems as a result. An attorney for KBR wants a federal judge here in Portland to throw the case out, saying the court in Oregon lacks jurisdiction. And the KBR attorney's name? Stephen Deathrage.
The chickens have come home to roost. Well, we have a story here. Very often we take a look at indie media, always a wonderful source of entertainment and often news. Apparently, Martin Macias, an independent media reporter from Chicago, is on his way to cover the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, and he was rejected at the border by Canadian agents and held without outside contact for at least 7 hours. Macias arrived in Vancouver from Chicago on Delta on Saturday. He was detained at the border at Vancouver International Airport and questioned about his plans during the Olympics. Ultimately, he was refused entry into Canada. He's then put on an Alaskan Airlines flight to Seattle. Don't know how that's going to help him get back to Chicago, but I suppose once you've been turfed out at the border, you're on your own. The Canadian authorities have been coming down like a veritable hammer on those who it suspects of being not entirely 100% cheering for the 2010 Olympics, and have got some hard questions to ask the sponsors and the promoters and indeed the visitors attending the games. We are now going to speak with Ben Cannon, representative from Portland. Yesterday, the Oregon House passed a bill that protects Oregon's coastal waters from offshore oil and gas drilling for the next decade. The story goes, state officials first adopted a drilling moratorium in the 1990s. Lawmakers readopted a 3-year ban in 2007, bringing us up to the present. Good morning, Representative Cannon.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning on short notice and all that. Can you talk a little bit about what this piece of legislation, what this accomplishes?
Yeah, you described it pretty well. The bill extends Oregon's moratorium on offshore oil and natural gas drilling for the next 10 years. So assuming that it passes the Senate and is signed by the governor, Oregon's territorial sea, which extends just the first 3 miles off Oregon's coast, will remain a place where fishing and crabbing and recreational activities are the primary use of our remarkable ocean resources here.
The question, of course, that comes to mind is that's approximately 3 miles. There is a lot of talk in the oil and gas exploration industry about new technology that makes it possible to drill in very deep waters.
Right.
Are we in any way protected from that?
Yeah, beyond, that's a great question. Beyond 3 miles falls under federal jurisdiction. So the federal government, the Obama administration, would make decisions related to the leasing of farther offshore areas for oil or gas exploration, and our legislation does not directly control that. However, it does send a very strong statement to the administration and to Congress that Oregon remains opposed to bringing this, highly contaminating activity into Oregon's ocean waters. So while we don't, as a state, we cannot directly impose a ban on those farther offshore areas, really up to several hundred miles off the coast, we can send a strong statement of opposition to oil and natural gas drilling in this really pristine and sensitive marine environment.
And the other question I have for you, though, is the time frame. 10 years always looks like a lot of time at the outset. Is this a type of legislation, something which can be extended with minimal fuss or controversy? Are we stuck with it, or is there any? What are the chances of making this a more permanent?
Yeah, the bill that was the bill I introduced was a permanent ban, and after talking with my colleagues and sort of counting up the votes, I supported the amendment to reduce it to just 10-year moratorium. That's four times stronger than the previous 2.5-year moratorium. So I think if we're able to get it to the governor's desk with the 10 years, we can all feel pretty good about that. However, it's not the same and not as secure as a permanent ban. And I certainly would support any attempt the legislature might make in subsequent sessions to extend this beyond 10 years. And obviously, if in 2020 I'm still a member and the ban is expiring, I would expect at that time to support the extension or making it permanent then. In some respects, it's sort of an academic question because any future legislature can do whatever it wants. There's no, we could have passed a permanent ban today and next year come back and revoked it. So we have no ability to control future legislatures. But I do think the message that's sent by a long moratorium, 10 years or longer, or a permanent ban is, is a very strong one to potential developers of oil or natural gas. We're saying, look, if you want to do this, you're going to have to make a return trip to the Oregon legislature and get 31 members of the House and 16 members of the Senate and the governor to overturn this ban. And at least in the next 10 years, that's what they would have to do.
Thank you very much for that. My guest has been Representative Ben Cannon of Portland again. Thank you so much. And again, for joining us this morning on Air Cascadia. And thank you so much for your hard work on getting this very important piece of legislation through.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The case of Eugene police officer Judd Warden tasing a Chinese student goes before the Civilian Review Board tonight. But even if the board disagrees with Police Chief Pete Kern's exoneration of Officer Warden, it cannot change the chief's decision or impose discipline on Warden. It can only comment on the police investigation.
And finally, as many people already know, Democrat John Merthyr, who was the representative for Pennsylvania, died yesterday at the age of 77 from complications from a recent gallbladder surgery. And pretty much anywhere on the Internet, you can get plenty of information about John Merthyr's life, history, and contribution to American political life.
This has been Air Cascadia for Tuesday, February 9th, 2010. Engineering is Janet Anderson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You've been listening to News and Comment from Air Cascadia on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. KBOO.fm on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members. And don't forget, you can always become a member by going to the KBOO website and clicking on Join Now.
Stay tuned now for Flashpoints. Kevin Pina from Haiti, an Israeli peace activist on corporations that profit from the occupation of Palestine, and Mumia Abu-Jamal on the recent Supreme Court decision sending his case back to an appeals court.
Thanks for listening, thanks for your support, and have a good day.